Okay.
Yeah, looks like it's working. So. Any questions before we get started today?
So far.
Been pretty basic stuff. And again, this starts what I call classification and nomenclature. Again, to me, it's pretty basic stuff too, but it's stuff that I do every day type of stuff. So again, if it doesn't, what's that?
The type section, that this is going to be all new to me.
That's good. That's what I'm getting to, is if I seem like I'm assuming you guys know something or that, just because it's something I do all the time, stop me and say, wait a minute, I don't know this stuff. So that's fine. Anyway, we're going to talk about classifications and nomenclature for a couple days here, probably, at least. Start out, I mean, what is classification? We talked about that a little bit last time, but we didn't talk too much about the purpose of classifications. Basically, I tell people that taxonomy or systematics forms the foundation that everything else, scientifically, or at least biologically, kind of depends on. We provide the names of all the organisms. Just think, if all of these organisms we study in that didn't have any names, how are you going to store information about them? How are you going to retrieve information about them? And so we kind of do that. We study these and make sure each different kind of organism has a different name. And then anything you, in your studies, you learn about it, that information gets stored in this huge, picture it like a huge file cabinet almost. And the information goes into that folder under that name. Somebody else comes along and wants to find out something, they can go and look under that name. And like I said, we use a hierarchical type classification where groups of species are lumped together into a genus, groups of genera put together into a family, and so on. This file and retrieval system could be done all different kinds of ways. You could just store everything alphabetically. It'd be a lot harder. I mean, today's day and age with all the fancy computers, it probably doesn't matter to it anymore. But when this came through development, we didn't have all these fancy computers, so they needed some better organized way to do it, to file and retrieve this stuff. As we talked about last time too, I mentioned that we try to make our classifications based on relatedness or phylogeny. Who's related to who? Again, you could have other kinds of classifications. I think last time I said you could lump all the red insects together and all the blue insects together, and there nothing relatedness, but it is a classification. We call that an artificial classification. But as I mentioned last time, if we can base our classifications on relatedness and have related animals grouped together, then your classification is more powerful and more robust, and it gains us predictive value. Mm-hmm. Again, if you know 10 species in a genus and they're all aquatic, feeding on a certain aquatic plant, and you find another one that's new, undescribed, that came to your light, and you wonder, well, I wonder what this thing does for a living. Well, you can go and look, see what the other 10 do, and you give a pretty good guess. Well, the one you caught probably does the same sort of thing. So, not always, but usually it gives you that predictive value. We also, last time already, went through the obligate categories. Got all these fancy colors of markers up here, but I like to use black because black erases. Surprisingly, black erases real easy. Some of these colors, you can't hardly get them to erase them. Anyway, we've got kingdom. And for our group, it would be Animalia. The next one down is the phylum. Arthropoda.
And I heard somebody say class already, insecta, which Mitch may, as we'll get later on, that we may see that this has changed some. They now a lot of times call it hexapoda, because things like the real primitive groups, Calambula and Proturas and stuff, they kind of don't say that. They say they're not really true insects anymore. But we'll talk about that later.
I can remember my entomology professor once gave us a multiple choice question and said there's only one answer to this one particular question, and it was what are insects classified as, insectopoda, hexapoda, and I can't remember what the last one was, but regardless, back then I was like, it's either insecta or hexapoda.
Yeah. Well, and again, we'll get to that later. I like to point out what names mean. Hexa, of course, is six, and poda is feet.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the six-footed animals. Next would be order. And there's, of course, lots of orders that we'll be talking about. If we just, for an example, Hemiptera is an order. And then family. And again, for my group, that would be Pentatomidae, but there'd be lots of families. Genus and species. That's 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Mm-hmm. So there's the obligate categories. And as I said last time, every animal will have a name in each of these categories. Taxonomic categories. There's lots more categories, and oftentimes it's done just by using the prefixes sub or super. For example, there's subgenus in here. Sub meaning below, so it's below genus. Super means above, so, well, actually, I take that back. I don't know any super genera, but we can do it at this family thing. There's subfamily and there's superfamily. There's also a few other categories in there that don't do this sub and stuff. For example, in here there's tribes.
Yeah, there are
tribes right below, right in here. Tribes.
Is that is that like just below subfamily and like?
Yeah, it's between the genus and subfamily.
Okay. That's not confusing at all.
Yeah, we see that a lot with Coleoptera. It's like 13 tribes.
Yeah, there's a lot of tribes.
Insects,
yeah. Yeah, and then there's even other groups. Well, in my group, they've got what we call, I guess that would actually be up here farther. In here, there's a group called infraorders. But yeah, there's tribes are used a lot in different places. Now, and it may be a little bit farther on the notes, but this seems like a good time to do it. There are some required endings for some of these groups. For example, family name always ends in IDAE.
Okay.
Subfamily always ends in INAE. And tribe always ends in INI. So at least in the family group names, there's these required endings. So if you see a name that ends in INAE, you might not know anything else about it, you can say that, but you would know that's a subfamily. So it's actually redundant if you say something like, this belongs in the subfamily Pentatomidae. But want to make sure I don't miss stuff. So these are taxonomic categories. Last time you asked about the definition of what a taxon was.
Yes.
Actually, in my notes right here, it just says it's a group of organisms classified together. For example, Apidae or the bees. But it's, you know, these are specific. You know, we'd say the family Apidae. But if you're talking in more general terms, it kind of applies to all of these. I can say, you know, use the word taxon at different levels in here. It's just a group of organisms that are classified together. Plural would be taxa if you're talking about more than one taxon. Now, one thing, and this is what I found a little bit disconcerting when I first started out, but all these classifications, I mean, your book will have a classification in that, but they should be just considered to be an hypothesis. It's somebody's feeling that this is how things should be arranged. Meaning as we continue to study the groups and do experiments, especially these days now with the molecular genetics and finding out all the DNA and all that, things change. You know, so it's just like, it's like any other scientific endeavor. You know, I think there's this feel that when we put out a classification, non-taxonomous, like, okay, that's it. And then a year later, we come back and say, well, you know what? The tiger beetles are no longer tiger beetles. They're just ground beetles. You know, that we found out some more information in that. So it changes, just like every other scientific endeavor, as you find out more information and stuff. And like I said, it always, early on, it kind of bothered me. And as I get older, I resist change more and more, I think. But anyway, it's just a hypothesis that we're working, that as we get more information. As I mentioned last time, too, we do have rules that govern a lot of what I do. And we'll talk about some of this. But this was this International Code of Zoological Nomenclature. And I didn't find my more recent editions. This one was the 1961 edition. But this is one of the little books that has all the guidelines. It's interesting that, at least for a long time, maybe still, I think still, they still think the official language, we actually have two official languages in taxonomy. And it's not, I mean, for this stuff, you know, everything's got to be in Latin, scientific names, but the official languages are English and French. If you look at this book, see, it's English on one side, and it's the same thing on this side in French. And so this is the same information as that is, just facing pages are in French and English. In the later editions, I think they did English in the front half of the book, and then they did it all over again in French or vice versa. So anyway, we do have rules or guidelines. A lot of these are put forth as rules, and then they have recommendations for us to follow. As I said last time, there's no taxonomy police if you don't follow the rules, and there are quite a few people that get tired of having to follow the rules, and so they do go off on their own. And the way it's kind of governed is just by peer pressure and acceptance by the colleagues. And if somebody goes off too far, they actually can commission, there's a committee that you can petition to, and they'll make decisions on certain things. And if somebody goes too far off the grid, you can actually have their works officially rejected. I don't know of any too many recent ones that have that happen, but some of the old things, the one I think I mentioned, the amniote thing that just used mononomial nomenclature, didn't use binomial, it's been officially rejected. None of the names he proposed are used by anybody anymore. But there's people, you know, there's certain criteria that has to be met for a publication to be valid. If you're describing new species, it's got to be in a publication that's widely dispersible, reproducible. and go through a peer review process type of thing. Well, there's some people that don't like the peer, in the past, that have not liked the peer review process. And so what do? Well, nowadays they can do it on the computer, but the ones I'm thinking about, they went out and bought their own printing press and printed their own journals and didn't have anybody peer review it. And strictly speaking, their works haven't been rejected. There's a guy out in California named Bliven who did this in my group. Published his own journal, described a lot of new species, and they weren't very good. He got some things right. He got some things right, but a lot of it wasn't. And he was kind of a loner, too. And so he wouldn't let anybody see his collection, so you couldn't check to see. You know, if you couldn't tell from his description, it's still good to go back and look at the specimens. Eventually, of course, he passed away, and his collection ended up being donated to the California Academy of Sciences. So now we can go in and look at the actual specimens he based his descriptions on, and a lot of his stuff has been synonymized in that. But anyway, that's how it's, I mean, there's my group, there's some people, and a guy in Pakistan that's publishing lots of stuff that's not, I can just tell from the descriptions, they're not good species. But unless you can see the specimens, there's not a whole lot you can do about it. You can read the descriptions and kind of say, well, this sounds like this is the same thing as this over here, but you can't prove it unless you actually see his specimens. And of course, fortunately here, this guy, some of his early funding came from the United States, and so he was required to put some of his specimens in the U.S. National Museum. But his later work, he didn't have to do that. And so all his types are in Pakistan, where it's almost impossible to see them. So this code of zoological nomenclature, one of the main guiding principles behind it is what we call the law of priority. Okay? Essentially what the law of priority is whoever did it first gets credit. So if you've got a species and you think it's new, and you describe it as a new species, and then a year or two later you find out somebody in 1945 described the same thing, it just hadn't been in the literature a lot, so we didn't know about it or it was overlooked, they still get credit. Your name becomes a synonym of their name because they did it first. So essentially, whoever does it first is supposed to get credit. And again, we had a cutoff date, that's 1758, where Linnaeus's Systema Naturae is the cutoff date. We don't go past that. An underlining premise behind this, though, is also to promote stability. We don't like there to be a lot of changes. Most changes, like I just described, involve species that aren't talked about very much, and that they don't mind. But what if in my group there's a major pest species? Well, we could even use Halomorpha halis. You guys know about that, the brown marmorated stink bug. And so there's all this literature. I mean, people are studying that like crazy in Europe and South America, and here it's just, what if I'm looking through some old literature and all of a sudden I discover way back in the very beginning somebody else described Halomorpha halis under a different name. Maybe they named it Pentatoma fuscus because it's brown. And that's the older name. The law of priority says, well, that's the name we got to use. And all of a sudden you've got all of this research and all of this literature under a different name. And so in this case, if it's really obvious, you can just do it and just say, we're going to suppress the oldest name in lieu of wanting to maintain stability. In some questionable cases, then you would actually again petition this committee and give your case and plead to them on why we should to reject the oldest name and keep maintaining the newer one. And if it's, again, a lot of times they'll go along with that. So again, law of priority is the big principle. Who did it first gets credit. But if it really disrupts the stability, then it can be overlooked that you can reject some older names to maintain the stability. Does that make sense?
So is there like a certain threshold where they say there's not enough literature to say let's not change the name?
There actually is. And I don't know the exact figures. I'd have to go look it up. But they say something like if one name has been used more than 50 times in the last 100 years and the older name has been used less than 10 times in the last 100 years, then it's a clear-cut case. And again, those numbers, I may not have the numbers right, but you're right. This actually, I think it's just the latest version of this code, which I think came out in around 2000. So we're about getting due for a new one. But they do have it spelled out there on. But that then requires you to really search the literature and have to come up with the names and stuff. And it can get tough. I'm working with a Brazilian guy on a genus name that's the same way. The genus Pygoda was actually synonymized under something else. And since it was synonymized, it didn't get used very much. But it got used a few times. And actually, I discovered an older genus name that hasn't been used at all. And the guy in Brazil who kind of works on that group, I told him about this, and he said, well, we need to keep the newer name, you know, suppress that old name. But it didn't meet those numbers that you talked about. It hadn't been used, the newer one hadn't been used enough times and stuff. And so we've now decided we're going to change it and go with the older name. That genus Pygoda will now become the genus Centroproctus, I believe. So I talked about being a valid publication. Well, if you want your name to be valid, if you're describing a new species, it does have to meet some criteria. One, it has to be binomial, or in the case of a subspecies, trinomial. I should have mentioned that. Well, actually, this is in this thing. It has to be binomial in the case of a species, or trinomial if you're doing a subspecies. We can't do mononomial. And there's nothing more than trinomial. You can't have quadrinomial. I don't even know what you'd call that now. There you're getting into varieties and forms and stuff, which prior to this code, 1961, a lot of people did describe varieties and forms. And the Germans called them aberrations. And we couldn't tell... Before 1960, we couldn't tell whether they were intending those to be subspecies names or whether they were actually describing forms and varieties. And so since we can't assume anything, we still treat names that were described as varieties or forms before 1960, we treat them as subspecies names and synonymize them or raise them up and down. After 1960, things described as varieties or forms have no taxonomic meaning at all. We don't recognize those new ones. They're not valid names anymore.
Are varieties and forms broken down towards like ecotypes and like local kind of?
Yeah, there may be, you may have a species that feeds on two different host plants, and they kind of start to segregate a little bit. And those on sorghum kind of look a little different than the ones that are feeding on a wild grass. And yet they'll still intermate in that. Now, I'm not saying, I'm saying taxonomically we don't recognize them. The applied people and biology and all that may still describe varieties and forms and use that in those contexts, but they don't have any taxonomic standing. So... the names have to be Latinized, Latin or Latinized, which actually you can make up any kind of a word. You can just jumble 9 letters together that have never been together before and add a Latin ending to it, and it's been Latinized. So, again, it has to be given to a species or subspecies. I already talked about that. It has to be based on actual specimens or fossils, or before 1931, it could be more based on products of the animals, like galls. Before 1930, you could describe a new species based on the gall shape and all that. Now you can't do that. You have to actually describe it on a real insect. And we don't recognize hypothetical animals. You can't describe a new species of a unicorn, for example. So that'd be kind of cool. You know, this is for animals. The plant people have their own code.
Fungi people probably have their own code. Bacteria people.
That's what I was just thinking. I thought of this today when I was getting ready for this lecture. Wouldn't it be cool if there was a code for hypothetical animals? So a whole group.
The mythical kingdom.
Huh? Oh, all those animals in the Harry Potter movies and stuff. Are they following the proper names? Actually, one of my past students, Eduardo Fondez, he named a number of new species, and he did name some of them after character or animals in the. I think we have one called Ecledra Nazgul and stuff. So he named some after some Star Wars people too, and so.
Nice.
For a name to be valid, of course, you have to write a description, and preferably you have to not just describe it, but you need to tell how it's different from other species in that genus. Or at least say, this species is related to this species, here's how it's different from that one. So it's desirable anyway to provide a description and then also still have a diagnosis telling how it's different from other species in that genus. In animals, the descriptions don't have to be in Latin. I mean, English, German, French, Russian, you can see them in all different languages. Plants, it used to be that they had to be in Latin. I think now they can have descriptions in other languages, but they still got to include at least a little diagnosis in Latin. Or at least the last time I checked, they did. It may not be so anymore. So, it's not, I talked about you can just kind of make up names and stuff. Truthfully, they say it's desirable to give it kind of a descriptive name. And like I've said, viridis means green, fuscus means brown, or some morphological characters or that. But it doesn't have to be. And a lot of times people describe things and give it a geographical name, Brasiliensis. Up here, we've got the one butterfly that we do survey work for that's kind of endangered. Is its species name is Dakota, the Dakota skipper. And that. The problem with that is if I name something, say, Ecuadoriensis, and then a few years later I get a whole bunch of specimens from Paraguay, then Ecuadoriensis doesn't seem to be as appropriate as it might have been. Also, people will name things after other people. We'll learn a little bit later. It's got a special name. They call those patronyms. And where that mainly got started is the olden days. All these naturalists would have people that would donate money to them, give them money to go on these trips. And then when you got back, anything new, some of the things you found that were undescribed, you'd name it after your donors, hopefully, probably, so they'd give you more money for the next one. But now it's not done so much for donors anymore. But if I send specimens, for example, one trip I went to Puerto Rico, and I got some ambush bugs, Phymatidae, that I don't work on. And at that time, there was a guy in the United States who did work on them. And so I sent my Phymatids to him so he could look them over and study them. And sure enough, he found an undescribed species and he named it after me. So there's a ambush bug from Puerto Rico named Rider Eye. But it's just sometimes you name it after whoever collected it and sent it to you. A lot of times, though, these days, it's people that you respect and that. In fact, when people are getting close to retiring, they'll have what they call a Festschrift issue in a journal where 10 or 20, maybe more, people get together and they all publish papers in this one journal. And typically, you know, it might be after Ernst Heiss, who works on Herodids in Austria. He had one a few years ago, and everybody named species after him to commemorate his lifetime of work and stuff. So I forget how many I've got. I've got about 7 or 8 or 9 species named after me right now, mostly stink bugs. Other stink bug workers have named some stuff after me. And I do have one genus too, Ridariana is a genus that's out there. So, in the old days, I said, you know, preferably it be a description. Before these rules got all set forth in the olden publications, it didn't have to have a description. If somebody published a name in a journal and just referred to a picture, that was enough to establish a name as a new description. In fact, an interesting case. Somebody was got a collection of bugs, I think, from either Panama or Ecuador, and was going to describe some new species. Well, some of them were spectacular looking, beautiful colors. And I think part of the money that came for that trip that got these specimens was through the National Geographic magazine. And the photographer took a picture of one of those beautiful stink bugs, and in the caption put down the name this guy was going to use to describe it. And he didn't actually describe it till a couple years later. Well, he doesn't get credit anymore, because at that time all it took was putting a name in a publication and referring to a picture. And so the photographer or the editor of that magazine got credit as describing that species. You can't do that anymore. So and then it has to be properly published, and that's a kind of a changing thing. Like I said, it has to be in a publication that's somewhat accessible on a widespread. I mean, people got to be able to see your paper. You can't publish it in some little journal that only is in your little city and nobody else can see it type of thing. And then it needs to be peer-reviewed. You know, have your peers review it and judge it. And so that one thing through our time is whether graduate student theses and dissertations count as a valid publication, because you do have a committee that looks it over, and they do end up in libraries, and that outfit through Michigan used to distribute them. So strictly speaking, it probably meets the criteria, but again, in other countries and stuff, so anyway, my dissertation, I described a bunch of new species in my dissertation, but I put a disclaimer in the front of it that said this should not be considered a publication. You know, the names used herein are not valid until I actually published it in a journal, which I did go ahead and do, publish it in a journal article. But I wanted it to be done right, and so I didn't want my dissertation, and a lot of people do that, so. But anyway, that's a big, big deal. Nowadays, of course, the big thing is a lot of these journals are now online. And so there's some new criteria that has to be thought of on whether those are valid publications of a new name. Because, you know, you put something online and you find out that you made some spelling errors. Well, you can go in and correct those and just put a new version up online the next day. Well, what's the date of publication? Was it when it first went up? It's when you corrected it? And so now online publications, they do have criteria, so they can be valid, but it has to be, you know, up online, can't be changed. And then also it has to either be in, the journal has to be in print form someplace, so there is a hard copy. or at least you can put it on a CD and have it distributed to some library. So it's not something that can be changed easily. You know, if you didn't like the name you used and you want to change the name, you can't go and change it. So anyway, the take home is this, that there is some criteria in having to deal with online publications now. Still got some time. So, how am I doing? I may end up jumping around. Is there stuff on your outline that I didn't have it in?
Type, species,
subspecies. Oh, I didn't go through binomial or trinomial. Just to emphasize this, this again is second nature to me, but maybe. When you write a scientific name, a binomial name, mm-hmm. the genus name is always has the first letter capitalized. Okay. The species name does not have it capitalized. Okay. Whoever described that species, we put the author name out here afterwards. So if I describe Thyanta Pernitor, and then they would put my name out here. Now, sometimes you'll see a scientific name where the author's name is in parentheses. That actually means something. You know what it means? It means that this species is no longer in the genus that it was originally described in. For example, Linnaeus and Fabricius described all the stink bugs in the genus Simex. All of them were, pretty much all of them were in Simex. So you could have Simex viridula, and it was Linnaeus 17, sometimes they'll put the date when it was published, 1758. Somebody more recently has moved this species. It's no longer in this genus. In fact, this is a genus of bed bugs now, Simex Lectularius. So this species is now in the genus Nazara viridula. Linnaeus is still the author. He's the one who described it. But now you put it in parentheses, and all that says is this species is no longer in the original genus. It's now in a different genus. And this is how we do it in zoology. The plant people will actually also include the person who moved it. So they may see this Linnaeus, and then it'll have like Smith after here. So they'll still give the original author who described it, and then another name. This is the person who moved it to the genus it's in. Again, zoologists don't do that. Also, scientific names are usually written in italics. If, and now italics is not a problem most times, when we used to work back in my early days when I had to work on a typewriter. You guys know what a typewriter is? I mean, the old things even before the word processors. We couldn't do italics easily. So the way we would denote italics is you would underline the words. So you'll see old publications where scientific names are just underlined. Truthfully speaking, the italics is not really signifying a scientific name. It's signifying that it's in Latin. For example, like if your other Latin terms are often italicized, like, for example, if you use EG, for example, in parentheses and something else, truthfully speaking, I mean, that's an abbreviation of a Latin term. It should be in italics. Or what's that?
It's like exempla gratifa.
Yeah, something like that. Or et cetera. Or et al. Those are all Latin terms that, truthfully speaking, strictly speaking, should be italicized. So italics really isn't tied to it because it's a scientific name. It's tied to it because it's in Latin. Okay, that covered that little... Okay, that's, man, that's just the first page of that. Okay. And so, next thing on your thing is types. Okay, that's what I went through. The date I put down there is the date that it was originally described. And see, this is where the online stuff even gets trickier. It's because now a lot of journals are coming out and putting up papers that aren't published yet. They'll say this is an early online version of it. And so a lot of times you'll see, and they won't be paginated or anything. They'll just have this early copy. Or while it's still in the review process, they'll put it up. And then it may be several months later before the final version gets put up. Well, sometimes that crosses years. If the early one came up in December, it might be December of 2018, but the final one doesn't come out till February of 2019. You know, what's the date of publication for that name? And I think for a lot of stuff that we just cite, we go for the early date, but for names, I think we make it be the last permanent final copy is the date, so it would be in 2019. A scientific name, a species name, can only be used once within a genus. You can't have, in this case, you can't have two Nazara viridulas. You know, so you know what we call those? They're hominins. That's when you use the same name for two species. Two or more species, mm-hmm. even. And it's surprising how often this actually happens. Back in the past, it happened a lot because there wasn't a lot of, the communication wasn't very good. And so it's fairly common for somebody over here to name something Nazara viridula, and somebody over here in a different place describe a Nazara viridula. Nowadays, where this kind of comes up more often is when species gets moved. You know, they might have named a Nazara viridula, and I might have named a Chlorochroa viridula. They're both green. But then somebody else might come along and say, well, my species isn't a Chlorochroa. I put it in the wrong genus. It's actually a Nazara. And so they'll move it into that genus. And then all of a sudden, well, now we've got two species in that genus named Viridula. And you can't have that. So somebody would probably then go and give my name a new species name. And actually, I've got two or three papers back early in my career where the cataloging work, I discovered a lot of homonyms. And the same thing goes up the ladder. You can't have two genera by the same name. And that actually happens a lot, especially older times. There wasn't any good means of keeping track of generic names. Because we're talking about all of zoology. You can't have the same two, can't have a genus name in the tigers be the same as a genus name in the stink bugs. And so that's pretty hard to track all that. Now, starting in the mid-1900s, somebody started compiling all the generic names in zoology. And now it's done online even. And so there is ways that we can track that. It still happens sometimes if people don't take the time to, you know, if they come up with a name they want to use, they still need to go through and check to make sure nobody's ever used it. And people still sometimes don't do that. So we still see generic homonyms. And it's the same thing. The newer one has to be given a new name. If there's no good synonyms, we have to look for that. So I just mentioned synonyms. Homonyms are when you use the same name for two species. A synonym is when you have two or more names
for the same species. Down here where I can't write very well.
So homonyms is same name, two species, and synonym is multiple names for one species.
Yeah, so it's maybe a little confusing, but they're different. You know, homonyms is one name for more than one species. Synonym is two or more names for the same species. The same case where I said I did Chlorocroa virigula, they may end up moving that into this genus and say it's the same genus, they may say, well, even the species is the same. Well, then it's a homonym and a synonym both, because it's... But that happened, synonyms is very common. I mean, we all have different judgments of what a species is. I don't know, that may be in my notes here that we'll talk about, but generally speaking, we actually have a definition what a species is, the biological concept, you know. I'm sure you've had that in your biology classes, two or more groups that are reproductively isolated and produce fertile offspring type of thing. And so we have a definition. It's not always easy to test, especially for museum specimens. You can't tell if they'll interbreed or not. But it should be a little bit more subjective. But still, people still have different concepts and stuff. That's where I say, but then when you go up the ladder on these categories, it becomes species should be more objective. The later, higher up ones become more subjective. I mean, what's the definition of a genus?
It's a
group of related species. But how do you tell what species are related? I mean, I may think one character eye color is real important. If they all got red eyes, they belong together. You may say, oh, that's not important, color of eyes. It's whether something in the male genitalia, if they're all the same. And so it may break out a different group. And so it can get much more subjective at higher up levels. So, sometimes we get these homonyms and synonyms arise when we use subspecies. If you describe a subspecies and then somebody else later decides they don't think it's a subspecies, it's actually a good species. If you haven't watched the names, you don't change the name, it just gets moved to the species level. Well, it may have already been used again. So again, you could create a homonym or a synonym that way. Now, we're actually getting close to being done. I might still just talk a little bit about types. When I go and describe a new species, I have to designate some types. Erase a little bit of this, give me a little room. Again, there's, you know, I talked a little bit about the theological school and the typology, and my belief these days is that I'm not describing a specimen, I'm describing a species. You got to include the variation. So I kind of describe the species and then tell what the type specimen, how it's maybe different than all the others. There's other people that describe the type and then they have a paragraph talking about the variation. But anyway, if I say I have five specimens of a new species, I've got to pick one of those to be what we now call the holotype. That's the one single specimen that's most important that represents that species. And even though I believe more in describing a species rather than a specimen, you still have to pick this because you've got to nail down the name. What if here I had these five specimens that I thought was a new species,
What if in a few years somebody else comes along and they look at my specimens and say, well, there's actually two species there. He didn't have just one new one, there's two. What if these three all are one thing and these two are something different? What name goes to what? I mean, I used a name. If I didn't designate a holotype, say I named something Panatoma rufapes. If I didn't pick one specimen to represent that species, does this name go with these three or does it go with those two? There's no way to know, right? So by picking one, this is the representative. So now we know that this group will still be Panatoma rufapes, and this one needs a new name. So that's the main reason why you pick a type, is so you nail down that name. And then also, if there's any question on what's what, people, future scientists, will examine the holotype to make sure they know what it is, what that species is. They can compare it with their specimens and stuff. When I pick this one as be the holotype, the other four become paratypes, or what we call paratypes. Okay. So today, and this is required, you got it. You have to pick one to be the holotype, and all the others that you use to write your description are paratypes. In a lot of the older literature, they might have those same five specimens, but they didn't used to pick one specimen. And in this case, all five of them are called syntypes. There's some other terms that you sometimes see that might have been called co-types and stuff like that. But the most used term is that they're all called syntypes.
So if the author doesn't designate a holotype, all the specimens he used to describe that single species would be a syntype?
Mm-hmm. Okay. They're all syntypes. And this problem could still come up. So now I would come along and say, okay, there's five syntypes, but we need to pin this down. And I'll study it and probably try to pick the one that fits the description the best, again, has the best characters. And I will go through and pick, at a later time, pick one to represent the species. Now, in this case, it's no longer called a holotype. It's called a lectotype. Essentially, a lectotype is the same as a holotype. It's just one that somebody later picked. The original author didn't pick one. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And now all the others become what we call paralectotypes.
So if it's the original, it's holotype and paratype, and if it's after... And if it's not the original author, it's lectotype and paralectotype.
Okay. If somebody's designated them. If nobody's designated one, they're still syntypes. Mm-hmm. Another scenario. What if somebody... And this can apply to either of these cases. But if somebody had five specimens when they described a species. Maybe they picked one, so you got a holotype and paratypes, or maybe they didn't, so you'd have this. But what if their collection wasn't taken care of and dermestids came in and ate all of them? Or what if they were in a museum that a fire burned and burned all of them? So now all of a sudden, we don't have any types. If the species is easy to recognize, that there's no controversy, everybody knows what it is, we don't do anything. We just say, okay, that's what it is. But if there's any possibility of confusion, then it's still important to have a specimen represent that species. And so at a later date, I could come along and pick a specimen, say, I think this is the best specimen to represent this species. And in this case, you call it a neotype. Neo being new, a new type. And we often try to, we actually try to pick a specimen as close geographically as to where the original specimen came from. That gives a better chance for it to be what it's supposed to be. For example, there's a predatory species in the United States. It's often used for biological control. It's called Podysis maculoventris. And Say, have you heard of Thomas Say? Thomas Say is considered the father of American entomology. He's back in the 1820s, 1830s. But he published a lot of new descriptions of a lot of species in North America. And his collection's all been destroyed, mostly by dermestids, so it's not around. But he's the one who described this Podysis maculoventris from specimens from Louisiana. Well, there's a woman did her PhD dissertation on this. I guess it must be back in the 1980s, probably. And she wanted to do a neotype, set up a neotype for this species. This is when I was a graduate student in Louisiana. And so she contacted me down there and said, I need a good specimen of this thing from Louisiana to do as a neotype. She wanted to get one that was as close to the original type locality as possible. Okay, let's see, the types I got on here. I guess I didn't mention allotype. It's because I don't put a lot of weight on it. Going back to this situation, normally in most groups, we again pick for the holotype, we pick the specimen that best represents that species. And usually the best characters are in the male or female genitalia. Most of the time it's males. So we almost always pick a male for the holotype. A lot of people still want there to be a female, pick the best female to represent the species. So they may pick another one over here that's a female, and that's what would be called the allotype. So it's just a specimen of the opposite sex of the holotype. It has to be from the original description. Other than that other than being a specimen of the opposite sex, it really doesn't have any more importance than a paratype. Mm-hmm. I mean, the paratypes, kind of, it's like a beauty pageant. If for some reason the winner has to step down, you can take a paratype and make it electrotype or something. So if something happens to the holotype, then the paratypes become a little bit more important. But truthfully, paratypes are just specimens you use to make your description, and so it's helpful for other people to see your paratypes. But still, the holotype is the important one. And really, an allotype's not any more important than any of the other paratypes on taxonomic standing. So, also on your list, topotype. What do you think a topotype is?
Is that the type that best represents that species in the general locality?
It's close. Topotype, again, has no real importance. If those five specimens I originally had, again, came from Louisiana, and they were collected 100 years ago, and if I know the exact spot, I can go back to the same spot later and collect at the exact spot. And some people think that's important, and so they'll call those topotypes. Again, they don't have any real taxonomic standing. We don't do anything else with them, but it's just, I guess it again increases the odds that you got what you think you did if you collected some specimens from the exact same spot that the originals were collected. So that's all it is some specimens collected late at a later date from the same locality that the holotype came from. And the last one, and this is where we'll quit for today, but the last one on there is homotype. again, no real taxonomic standing, it's just a helpful thing. But a homotype is a specimen that's been compared with the holotype. Mm-hmm. So again, if this was this up here that we talked about, the holotype and allotype, was done by somebody around 1900, and these specimens are in a collection, I want to study that holotype, and I may have only a few minutes or limited time, so I can't sit there and write a nice description. Nowadays, we do take a, I often take a digital camera and take pictures. But if I don't have a lot of time, but I have an idea of what I think that is, I can bring some specimens from my collection and take with me. And in a few minutes, I can probably look at the holotype and then look at my specimens and say, ah, yeah, these two things are the same. My specimen, I'll put a label on there and call it a homotype. And that tells me, at least, that I think it's the same. And see, that's where the homotype is just my opinion. Somebody else, again, may have a different opinion. They may look at it and say, well, no, that's not the same as the holotype. So, but yeah, a homotype is just a specimen that's been compared with the holotype. And it helps me a lot. It's homotypes are based on the capabilities of the scientist. You may have a poor scientist who makes homotypes and say, geez, these are probably not right. Whereas the guy that I studied under at Louisiana State, Dr. Ralston, he did a lot of homotypes, and he was very good. He wasn't, and so, again, it's just his opinion. I can't verify for sure what he did is correct, but most of the time he was correct, and so it does help me a lot. I've made homotypes, and of course I put a lot of faith in my own homotypes, but so. So those are all those type words that you didn't know. Do they all make sense?
Yeah, they make sense now. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we can, again, I'll try to get these lectures up and stuff, and we can always rehash some of it. But that's where we'll quit for today. And we still got, well, next on there was definitions of species. I already did that some. And we can talk about subspecies. I see there's Klein on there. Types at the other levels, what the type of a genus family. We've talked a little bit about NIM words, but there's some more of those. And then I do want to finish this up by talking about voucher specimens and common names. We talk, most of the time we're working with scientific names, but I want to talk a little bit about common names too. So we'll work on that tomorrow. We'll shoot for going out Tuesday and Thursday of next week. I hope the weather holds up.
On Tuesday?
That's what I was getting ready to say, is we can talk about it tomorrow too, but I would about maybe shoot for 8 o'clock. What I would like to do next week is, if we could get away by 8, if it seemed like a decent day, we could go out to the Moorhead Science Center, get out there by 9, and even if we only spent a couple hours, we could still be back here around noonish or 1 o'clock. I'm hoping I can get some people, my wife or somebody, to help me with some other things, and Thursday, if it's nice, go farther away, down to Mirror Pool or something, and spend a little bit more time out, but I'll see if I can work that out. So, you know.